It's titled Joe Stiglitz, the Globalizer Who Came In From the Cold. The World Bank's former chief economist's accusations are eye-popping, including how the IMF and U.S. Treasury fixed the Russian elections. Palast writes, "It has condemned people to death," the former apparatchik told me. This was like a scene out of Le Carré. The brilliant old agent comes in from the cold, crosses to our side, and in hours of debriefing empties his memory of horrors committed in the name of a political ideology he now realizes has gone rotten. And here before me was a far bigger catch than some used Cold War spy. Joseph Stiglitz was the chief economist of the World Bank. To a great extent, the New World Economic Order was his theory come to life. I debriefed Stiglitz over several days at Cambridge University, in a London hotel, and finally in Washington in April 2001 during the big confab of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But instead of chairing the meetings of ministers and central bankers, Stiglitz was kept exiled safely behind the blue police cordons, same as the nuns carrying a large wooden cross, the Bolivian union leaders, the parents of AIDS victims, and other anti-globalization protesters. The ultimate insider was now on the outside. In 1999, the World Bank fired Stiglitz. He was not allowed quiet retirement. U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, I'm told, demanded a public excommunication for Stiglitz having expressed his first mild dissent from globalization World Bank style. Here in Washington, we completed the list of several hours of exclusive interviews for The Observer and BBTV's Newsnight about the real, often hidden workings of the IMF, World Bank, and the bank's 51% owner, the U.S. Treasury. And here, from sources unnameable, not Stiglitz, we obtained a cache of documents marked confidential, restricted, and not otherwise to be disclosed without World Bank authorization. Stiglitz helped translate one from Bureaucraties, a country assistance strategy. There is an assistance strategy for every poorer nation designed, says the World Bank, after careful in-country investigation. But according to insider Stiglitz, the bank's staff investigation consists of a close inspection of a nation's five-star hotels. It concludes with the bank staff meeting some begging, busted finance minister who was handed a restructuring agreement pre-drafted for his, quote, voluntary signature. I have a selection of these. Each nation's economy is individually analyzed then, says Stiglitz. The World Bank hands every minister the exact same four-step program. Step one is privatization, which Stiglitz said could more accurately be called briberization. Rather than object to the sell-offs of state industries, he said national leaders, using the World Bank's demands to silence local critics, happily flogged their electricity and water companies. You could see their eyes widen at the prospect of 10% commissions paid to Swiss bank accounts for simply shaving a few billion off the sale price of national assets. And the U.S. government knew it, charges Stiglitz, at least in the case of the biggest briberization of all, the 1995 Russian sell-off. The U.S. Treasury view was that this was great, as we wanted Yeltsin reelected. We don't care if it's a corrupt election. We want the money to go to Yeltsin via kickbacks for his campaign. Stiglitz is no conspiracy nutter ranting about black helicopters. The man was inside the game, a member of Bill Clinton's cabinet as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers. Most ill-making for Stiglitz is that the U.S.-backed oligarch stripped Russia's industrial assets, with the effect that the corruption scheme cut national output nearly in half, causing depression and starvation. After briberization, Step 2 of the IMF World Bank One Size Fits All Rescue Your Economy Plan is capital market liberalization. In theory, capital market deregulation allows investment capital to flow in and out. Unfortunately, as in Indonesia and Brazil, the money simply flowed out and out. Stiglitz calls this the hot money cycle. Cash comes in for speculation in real estate and currency, then flees at the first whiff of trouble. A nation's reserves can drain in days, hours. And when that happens, to seduce speculators into returning a nation's own capital funds, the IMF demands these nations raise interest rates to 30%, 50%, and 80%. The result was predictable, said Stiglitz, of the hot money tidal waves in Asia and Latin America. Higher interest rates demolished property values, savaged industrial production, and drained national treasuries. At this point, the IMF drags the gasping nation to step 3, market-based pricing, a fancy term for raising prices on food, water, and cooking gas. This leads, predictably, to step 3.5, what Stiglitz calls the IMF riot. The IMF riot is painfully predictable. When a nation is down and out, the IMF takes advantage and squeezes the last pound of blood out of them. They turn up the heat finally until the whole cauldron blows up, as when the IMF eliminated food and fuel subsidies for the poor in Indonesia in 1998. Indonesia exploded into riots, but there are other examples. The Bolivian riots over water prices last year, and this February, the riots in Ecuador over the rise in cooking gas prices imposed by the World Bank. You'd almost get the impression that the riot is written into the plan. And it is. What Stiglitz did not know is that, while in the States, BBC and The Observer obtained several documents from inside the World Bank, stamped over with those pesky warnings, confidential, restricted, not to be disclosed. Let's get back to 1, the Interim Country Assistance Strategy for Ecuador. In it, the bank several times states, with cold accuracy, that they expected their plans to spark social unrest, to use the bureaucratic term for a nation in flames. That's not surprising. The secret report notes that the plan to make the U.S. dollar Ecuador's currency has pushed 51% of the population below the poverty line. The World Bank's assistance plan simply calls for facing down civil strife and suffering with political resolve and still higher prices. The IMF riots, and by riots I mean peaceful demonstrations dispersed by bullets, tanks, and tear gas, cause new panicked flights of capital and government bankruptcies. This economic arson has its bright side for foreign corporations who can then pick off the remaining assets, such as the odd mining concession or port, at fire sale prices. Stiglitz notes that the IMF and World Bank are not heartless adherents to market economics. At the same time the IMF stopped Indonesia subsidizing food purchases, when the banks need a bailout, intervention in the market is welcome. The IMF scrounged up tens of billions of dollars to save Indonesia's financiers, and by extension, the U.S. and European banks from which they had borrowed. A pattern emerges. There are lots of losers in this system, but one clear winner: the Western banks and U.S. Treasury, making the big bucks off this crazy new international capital churn. Stiglitz told me about his unhappy meeting early in his World Bank tenure with Ethiopia's new president in the nation's first democratic election. The World Bank and IMF had ordered Ethiopia to divert aid money to its reserve account at the U.S. Treasury, which pays a pitiful 4% return, while the nation borrowed U.S. dollars at 12% to feed its population. The new president begged Stiglitz to let him use the aid money to rebuild the nation. But no, the loot went straight off to the U.S. Treasury's vault in Washington. Now we arrive at step 4 of what the IMF and World Bank call their poverty reduction strategy: free trade. This is free trade by the rules of the World Trade Organization and the World Bank. Stiglitz, the insider, likens free trade WTO style to the opium wars. That, too, was about opening markets, he said. As in the 19th century, Europeans and Americans today are kicking down the barriers to sales in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, while barricading our own markets against third world agriculture. In the Opium Wars, the West used military blockades to force open markets for their unbalanced trade. Today, the World Bank can order a financial blockade just as effective and sometimes just as deadly. Stiglitz is particularly emotional over the WTO's Intellectual Property Rights Treaty. It goes by the acronym TRIPS. It is here, says the economist, that the new global order has condemned people to death by imposing impossible tariffs and tributes to pay pharmaceutical companies for branded medicines. They don't care, said the professor of the corporation and bank loans he worked with, if people live or die. By the way, don't be confused by the mix in this discussion of the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. They are interchangeable masks of a single governance system. They have locked themselves together by what are unpleasantly called triggers. Taking a World Bank loan for a school triggers a requirement to accept every conditionality. They average 111 per nation, laid down by both the World Bank and the IMF. In fact, said Stiglitz, the IMF requires nations to accept trade policies more punitive than the official WTO rules. Stiglitz's greatest concerns is that World Bank plans devised in secrecy and driven by an absolutist ideology are never open for discourse or dissent. Despite the West's push for elections throughout the developing world, the so-called poverty reduction programs undermine democracy, and they don't work. Black Africa's productivity under the guiding hand of IMF structural assistance has gone to hell in a handbag. Did any nation avoid this fate? Yes, said Stiglitz, identifying Botswana. Their trick? They told the IMF to go packing. So then I turned on Stiglitz. Okay, Mr. Smart Guy Professor, how would you help developing nations? Stiglitz proposed radical land reform, an attack at the heart of landlordism, on the usurious rents charged by the propertied oligarchies worldwide, typically 50% of a tenant's crops. So I had to ask the professor, as you were top economist at the World Bank, why didn't the bank follow your advice? If you challenge land ownership, that would be a change in the power of the elites. That's not high on their agenda. Close quote. Apparently not. Ultimately, what drove him to put his job on the line was the failure of the banks and the U.S. Treasury to change course when confronted with the crisis, failures and suffering perpetrated by the four-step monetarist mambo. Every time their free market solutions failed, the IMF simply demanded more free market policies. It's a little like the Middle Ages, the insider told me. When the patient died, they would say, well, he stopped the bloodletting too soon. He still had a little blood in him. I took away from my talks with the professor that the solution to world poverty and crisis is simple. Remove the bloodsuckers. And that was Joe Stiglitz, the globalizer who came in from the cold, by Greg Pallast, from the October 10th, 2001 edition of The Observer of London.
Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. Cause all that you have is your soul. Here I am, I'm waiting for a better day. A second chance, a little luck to come my way. Hope to dream. Hope that I can sleep again. Awaken a world with a clear conscience and clean hands. Cause all that you have is your soul.
Before we get to the Wizards of Money, I need to share a news item with you of the most serious nature. It's urgent that you act in response to the event that I'm about to report. Last Thursday, armed government agents grabbed Nancy Oden, Green Party USA coordinating committee member, at Bangor International Airport in Bangor, Maine, as she attempted to board an American Airlines flight to Chicago. An official told me that my name had been flagged in the computer, a shaken Oden said. I was targeted because the Green Party USA opposes the bombing of innocent civilians in Afghanistan. Oden, a longtime organic farmer and peace activist in northern Maine, was ordered away from the plane. Military personnel with automatic weapons surrounded Oden and instructed all airlines to deny her passage on any flight. I was told that the airport was closed to me until further notice, and that my ticket would not be refunded, Oden said. Oden was scheduled to speak in Chicago the following night on a panel concerning pesticides as weapons of war. She had helped to coordinate the Green Party USA's anti-war efforts these past few months and was to report on these to the Greens National Committee. Not only did they stop me at the airport, but some mysterious party had called the hotel and canceled my reservation, Oden said. Oden told another Green Party member that she was personally flagged because she is an outspoken environmental activist and her name appears prominently on the Green Party USA webpage contact list. She says that this is a blatant attempt by President Bush to institute surveillance and intimidation. Citizens concerned about freedom of thought and association in this country are urgently requested to contact their senators and representatives and demand they take a stand on this and prove that they truly believe in and support those freedoms we are allegedly fighting for at this very moment. Let's make this a litmus test for their patriotism. For further information, please call 1-866-GREENS-2. That's a toll-free number, 1-866-GREENS-2. If you're a member of the news media or have contacts in media, urge them to cover this story. You might also wish to contact American Airlines and tell them you won't be taking any of their flights in response to their behavior toward Miss Oden.
The Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is the Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is part 5 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled Monetary Terrorism. In this 5th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at financial terrorism conducted by Western financial institutions, even as they freeze the assets of a different kind of terrorist. In the previous edition of Wizards, we discussed the dual role of the military system and the financial system in modern empires and how both systems facilitate the appropriation of foreign resources, which is the lifeblood of any empire. Today we will explore how certain currency regimes have come to dominate in this arena and have taken over from where various Cold War era military regimes left off. While the world's eyes are focused on the so-called war on terrorism and various acts of terrorism that come in the physical form, the US dollar and its primary wizards are busy wreaking havoc in other nations. As of late October, early November 2001, Argentina is struggling under the currency regime of mass destruction known as the dollar peg. This is the very same mechanism that helped bring down the financial and economic infrastructure of Mexico in 94-95, Thailand in 1997 and Indonesia in 1998, to name but a few casualties of this monetary weapon. During the current terror watch, some eyes have been checking on the sneaky attempts to pass through the FTAA, or the Free Trade Area of the Americas. But little attention has been paid to the stealth monetary weapon known as dollarization, which could have an effect more severe than any such trade agreement. On January 1 this year, El Salvador began the new year by taking the drastic step of so-called dollarization, which means making the US dollar the official currency of their nation. Guatemala took steps to do this year in May, but is not there yet. Ecuador has already dollarized, and now Argentina's government is saying that it would rather dollarize, meaning throw out its own currency. It would rather do this than devalue its currency to see itself out of its current debt crisis. Now, not only is Latin America coming under US monetary rule, but other less powerful nations, for example, the newly independent nation of East Timor, are being pressured to dollarize. As we saw in Wizards Part 1, even within the United States, money or credit creation in the US dollar is not democratic, but rather is the sole domain of private bankers and the Federal Reserve. At the international level, dollarization and other monetary weapons takes credit creation power completely out of the hands of other nations and places it squarely with the private financial sector of the United States. Recall the words of President Garfield shortly before his assassination, as we discussed in Wizards Part 4. Quote, "Whoever controls the supply of currency would control the business and activities of all the people." End quote. And if you believe in this, it would seem that once dollarization is in effect, the highly controversial free trade agreements are hardly needed at all. Dollarization would do the job of such agreements without all the hassles and public outcries associated with these documents that have to go through a more democratic process, little though it may be. Such is the mystery surrounding money and monetary policy that lengthy trade agreements get more attention than the simple move to formally adopt the currency of and relinquish all credit creation powers to the superpower. Dollarization gets little attention here because it can happen in foreign countries without any approval of the United States government, as is required for the international trade agreements, and it is often adopted in countries without even the approval or knowledge of a great many of its own people. But many countries probably feel that they are forced to dollarization because if they do not comply with the ruling monetary regime, speculators will eventually attack their currency anyway. This is a valid concern, for it seems that most nations in the developing world, other than those cut off from the international markets, have had their currencies attacked by speculators at some point in the past decade. In this way, speculators do act like a military force, going to war against foreign currencies or monetary systems and pounding them with their might until they win. Just like the US-backed military forces before them, they have more and mightier weapons. In the case of a military action during the Cold War, US-backed military forces could often physically attack a people until they gave up because the former had the most access to the most powerful weapons. The same is true of currency attacks by Wall Street firms and also of their European counterparts. But today in Wizards, we're just going to focus on the US dollar. So we'll focus on the US-based financial firms. The major firms that instigate the speculative attacks have access to more US dollars than the central banks of many countries. And remember that the US dollar is the linchpin of the international monetary system and forms the reserve backing up most foreign currencies. By having easy access to tremendous amounts of the mightiest monetary weapon in the world, these Wall Street firms have, in almost all cases, forced foreign currencies to collapse once they have initiated an attack. Faced with the problems brought about by overwhelming speculative attacks, as with overwhelming military action, countries increasingly seem to give up and go the way of dollarization to eliminate the threat of future currency attacks. This trend has profound implications as to lost sovereignty and a seemingly irreversible acceleration of the phenomenon labelled as globalization. To understand this relatively new trend, it is useful to look back into the history of the international monetary system over the past century or so to discover how things got to this point. We're going to take a look at the very special relationship between 20th century wars and major changes to the monetary system throughout the 20th century. World War II and the events leading up to it saw profound changes to the international monetary system and the mechanisms that countries would use to coordinate cross-border trade and financing. The most famous of these changes came in the form of the Bretton Woods Agreements, which was named after the meeting place in the United States where these agreements were drafted. These agreements created the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We'll just focus here on the IMF because this has more to do with contemporary monetary attacks than does the World Bank. Much of what will follow comes out of an economics text used by many trainee wizards in their studies called simply Economics, written by some real important wizards of this century. One of the wizards was David Begg, who's a professor of economics at the University of London. Another author is Stanley Fisher, who is a famous director at the International Monetary Fund, an economist at the World Bank, and also a professor of economics at MIT. The third author is Rüdiger Dombusch, who's also a professor of economics at MIT. The text on the International Monetary Fund in this trainee wizard book is translated into plain language by myself. To understand what the IMF was really created for, let's just take a peek at monetary arrangements before the Great Depression. Up until this time, many countries were on the gold standard, whereby their own currency was backed by gold reserves at their central bank. And remember that the central bank of a country is the creator of base money for any currency. So, for example, in the US, our central bank is the Federal Reserve, and they create base money in the form of bank reserves and also the currency notes we use, or Federal Reserve notes. In this time of the gold standard, in most countries, paper currency could be converted to gold. So just as in Roman times, this system meant that whoever had access to the most gold could do the most investing and acquire extensive ownership in foreign resources. And this was usually perfectly correlated with whoever had the most firepower and willingness to use it. This made Britain both the primary military and financial power in the 19th and early 20th centuries, with a late boost coming from its discovery of gold in South Africa. One of the main complexities of the international monetary system, which is the mechanism through which all international trade and investing happens, is the determination of the value of one country's currency against another, known as the exchange rate. For example, if we are to look at the exchange rate between the United States and the country of Australia, we would say today the exchange rate between the Australian dollar and the US dollar could be expressed as an exchange rate of almost 2 Australian dollars to 1 US dollar, or equivalently, 1 Australian dollar is worth half a US dollar or 50 cents. Before the Asian financial crisis, the exchange rate between the United States and Australia was closer to 1 Australian dollar for 0.7 US dollars or 70 cents. So we would say that the Australian dollar has since been devalued relative to the US dollar because it's gone from 0.7 to 0.5 US dollars. It buys less US dollars. This means that it is now more expensive for Australians to buy US products, and Australian products are cheaper for US consumers. The problem of managing exchange rates has troubled international relations for the past two centuries, and so far, none of the management regimes have worked out very well for the majority of the people living outside the United States and Western Europe. Any country involved in international trade would like their exchange rate relative to the currency of major trading partners to remain fairly stable and predictable and not to suffer sudden shocks. If their money supply suddenly loses value relative to other money, their imports cost more, and if it gains value, their exports become less competitive. The gold standard provided a way to stabilize exchange rates because every currency was convertible into a single common commodity, which was gold. Up until the Great Depression and under the gold standard, there was allowed a fairly free flow of capital between countries, and this is what kept exchange rates stable. However, on the downside, the central bank or the government of a country weren't easily able to change their own money supply to deal with pressing domestic problems such as unemployment or price inflation, because this supply was already affixed by gold movement. Also, in financial panics, there was more likely to be a collapse of the financial system because everyone would rush to change their money into gold and the whole banking system would start to break down. For these and other reasons, the gold standard for domestic money holders was abandoned by most countries during and after the Great Depression. But this meant that there was no longer any natural way to ensure stability of the exchange rates between different countries. It was recognized from the events leading up to the Great Depression and to World War II that some international agreement was needed to create a more stable international monetary system, and one that was to exist in the absence of a gold standard backing each individual currency. This is what gave birth to the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. In the aftermath of World War II, the United States was the dominant economic power because it was basically the child of the pre-war powers who had their economic infrastructure destroyed during the war. With the gold standard gone, it seemed to make sense to the powers that be for the whole world to move onto a US dollar standard where the value of every currency would be set against the value of the US dollar. In turn, the US dollar was fixed against the value of real goods by setting its value against gold as 35 US dollars for an ounce of gold. This was called the adjustable peg system, and the IMF was created to administer this system and put out fires as needed. Under the adjustable peg system then, many countries might hold US dollars, US government bonds, and gold to back their own national currency and keep their exchange rate fixed against the US dollar. Central banks could redeem their US dollars for gold at the fixed price, and this gold was stored at the very famous Fort Knox. Exchange rates would be stable as long as demand for US dollars remained fairly stable relative to demand for other currencies. Relative demand for any country's currency versus others depends on the relative flows of imports versus exports and desire for investment domestically versus investment abroad. To keep things fairly stable, under the original Bretton Woods Agreement, there were restrictions on cross-border investment capital flows to help reduce sudden jumps in supply or demand for a currency that come with speculative capital flows. The capital controls were necessary, otherwise speculators could have a field day by betting that a certain currency would go down by selling it off against the US dollar and thereby forcing it to go down purely from their speculative activity. Large financial firms with access to lots of US dollars could therefore force a foreign currency of a weaker country to collapse as they desired. These earlier restrictions on capital flows is a very key point, so please remember it, because this is a fundamental difference between the original Bretton Woods system and the commonly named post-Vietnam non-system that has allowed now sudden attacks and the collapse of Mexican, Asian, and Latin American currencies over the past decade. If a currency collapses, people of the affected country become a lot poorer very quickly, and things are much worse if the country has lots of debt denominated in US dollars. We have seen that when this happens, economic policies then introduced normally lead to increased poverty and unemployment, or employment at below poverty wages, as well as the selling off of natural resources to the West at fire sale prices. It is interesting to note that the two things that brought down the stabilizing mechanisms of the original post-World War II Bretton Woods system were America's extensive Cold War military adventures and the world's lust for oil through the 1970s oil shocks. Under the original Bretton Woods system with capital flow controls, the only thing that could change the relative demand for a currency against the US dollar peg was a serious trade imbalance. That means a large imbalance between a country's imports and exports. For example, if a non-US country's imports from the US exceeded its exports to the US by a lot, then its demand for US dollars exceeded the US demand for its currency. To make things balance, it could either devalue its currency against the US dollar or get US dollars somehow else, say by selling gold or borrowing US dollars. If a large temporary trade deficit came about, the IMF could lend US dollars to the country to stabilize its currency value while the deficit existed. But if it was a permanent imbalance of trade, the IMF would recommend a currency devaluation. For informational purposes, I should just say that this issue of management of trade deficits and barriers to trade and associated demand for currency provides the link between the IMF and the original GATT agreement, or General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which later metamorphosed into the World Trade Organization, or WTO. It is interesting that both agreements and institutions jointly deviated drastically from their original post-World War II mission in the late 20th century after the collapse of the original Bretton Woods system. Under this original Bretton Woods system, countries had some control over their own domestic monetary policy, so long as it didn't affect their balance of payments too much or their trade balance too much. And under capital controls, they were protected from excessive speculation. But then America's increasing military activity throughout Latin America, Asia, and Africa in the 1960s and 70s, followed closely by the OPEC oil shocks, radically altered the fundamentals of the monetary system throughout the rest of the 20th century. This culminated in severe currency attacks on many of the nations already wounded by the military apparatus several decades earlier. In fact, it is almost as if the earlier military efforts laid the groundwork for the later monetary attacks. Understand this point about the monetary attacks, let us first understand how the original Bretton Woods system collapsed. Throughout the 1960s, the United States was spending massive amounts of money abroad to fund various military operations that, while under the guise of the war against communism, was ultimately buying insurance on investments and economic interests abroad. While certain capital controls existed to prevent speculative pressure on currencies, U.S. investors still had many economic interests throughout these regions. A rise in democracy may have nationalized natural resources, created land reforms, and otherwise collapsed the value of U.S. investments. In turn, this would have had serious ramifications on the U.S. stock exchanges and reverberated throughout the whole financial system. The spending on the Vietnam War and other military adventures caused America to have a big and rather permanent trade deficit and greatly increased the supply of U.S. dollars abroad relative to U.S. gold reserves at home. President Nixon was forced to break the peg of the U.S. dollar to the fixed price for gold in 1971, and then the U.S. dollar kept decreasing in value with respect to gold as the U.S. increased its military activities abroad. This caused a huge disturbance, and soon the whole adjustable peg system had broken down. The IMF should have disbanded at this time because its founding mission did not exist anymore without the adjustable peg. Then OPEC came along and presented the world with its oil price shocks, and a lot of large nations started running significant trade deficits with the Middle East because the price of oil was now so high. This might have been oil's way of saying that now that the gold standard was completely dead, it would take over as the real good against which currency value should be assessed. Which was fairly appropriate since much of the human fighting had stopped being about gold and became about oil. The oil shocks and America's military spending seemed to have created pressure to break down the system of earlier capital flow controls, so that Western countries could balance their currency outflow from trade deficits with some inflow of investment capital from the OPEC countries who were making the big oil profits. So much money then rushed into the West as the so-called petrodollars that many financial institutions then turned around, and then the absence of capital controls and the absence of the gold peg lent the money as U.S. dollar denominated debt to many Latin American countries to earn some higher returns for themselves. Interestingly, a lot of this debt incurred in Latin America was being used to fund the purchase of military equipment by the U.S. favored regimes to assist in the war on communism. But the expansion of the U.S. money supply and the oil shocks led to such bad inflation problems in the U.S. that by the end of the 1970s, the U.S. Federal Reserve decided to rein them in by spiking up interest rates, which is the same as shrinking the U.S. dollar money supply. Many Latin American borrowers were on variable interest rates, and this spike in interest rates forced them to be about to default on their U.S. dollar loans. This threat of default marked the rebirth of the IMF, who had lost its founding mission upon the collapse of the Bretton Woods system during the Vietnam War, and transformed it into a wholly new entity governing today's monster of an international monetary non-system. To prevent financial panic spreading to the West upon such defaults, the IMF stepped in as lender of last resort to protect the Western creditors from getting hit by defaults. By giving such a blessing to the reckless behavior of international banks, the IMF introduced serious distortions favorable to these banks in the form of moral hazard that is still with us today. Moral hazard comes about when large investors are enticed into excessive speculation by the knowledge that they will get bailed out if their bets go bad. Under today's international monetary non-system, we have free flow of capital and persistent speculative attacks against economically weaker countries. To make matters worse, these countries have large amounts of US dollar denominated debt, a lot of which originally started from the petrodollars, and the IMF has made itself understood to be there to back up the big Western banks who get in trouble while speculating on these countries. This moral hazard, combined with the loss of original capital flow controls, has created a very bad situation for the majority of people in the developing world. So, how did a reasonably stable post-World War II international currency regime end up getting so nasty? The simple social answer is that too few people now have control over it, and they are the ones who benefit from the stupidity of the system as a whole. The more detailed technical answer can be understood by looking at the anatomy of a currency attack conducted by Wall Street, and then looking at what is known as the unholy trinity dilemma. Now let us study the anatomy of a currency attack by Wall Street. Recall that under the pre-depression era gold standard, exchange rates were automatically fixed and there were pretty free investment capital flows. But countries couldn't do very much about their own money supply to help with domestic monetary policy unless they went out and dug up more gold. Then under the post-World War II real Bretton Woods system, there were fixed exchange rates and countries had some ability to control their money supply for domestic policy purposes such as unemployment and inflation. This was possible because there were controls on investment capital flows. But now, after the collapse of the real Bretton Woods system, there are few capital controls and many of the smaller economies have tried to peg their exchange rate to the US dollar. Smaller economies try and fix their currency relative to the US dollar because for most countries, the US is a major trading partner and because they want to attract funds from US investors, so they want their currency to appear stable relative to the US dollar. However, Wall Street attacks have made this a recipe for disaster and regularly smashed smaller economies. Let's see how this happens. Let's suppose I am the central banker of a pretend country called Auslet, and I peg my currency, called the Auslettas, to the US dollar, so that one Auslettar equals one US dollar. I create and extinguish money in exactly the same way as the US Federal Reserve does, and as we spoke about in Wizards Part 1. That is, if I want to issue more Auslettas into the banking system, I go into the open market and buy US dollars or US government securities. The seller of the dollars or securities gets Auslettas in return and new Auslettas enter the banking system of Auslet. Then the banks of Auslet create another, say, 10 times this amount as bank money denominated in Auslettas, just like we spoke about with the US banks and US dollars in Wizards Part 1. If I would like to maintain a one-to-one currency peg with the US dollar, then as the central banker of Auslet, I would keep in reserve a one-to-one correspondence between US dollars or US denominated securities for every one Auslettar that I issue. Meanwhile, with free capital flow going on in my country, some US investors have decided that Auslet looks like a good investment opportunity and they are starting to buy up stocks and bonds in my country. This brings in some more US dollars into the country of Auslet, which buys assets denominated in Auslettas. This higher demand for Auslettas brings more reserves into my country, which allows me to expand the Auslettar money supply, and this may help create more investment and more jobs. Also, the government of Auslet and some banks and traders here are borrowing some US dollars because of the low interest rates on them and to facilitate their own international dealings. Over time, the borrowings of US dollars from US banks by our government in Auslet and by our banks is getting quite large. It gets especially large as the Western investors and World Bank are encouraging my country to borrow more and more money for infrastructure development so we can catch up with the West, they tell us. Then one day, a 25-year-old bright spark called Jimmy, who just got an MBA at Harvard and now works with a big Wall Street firm called Betters Inc., heard a rumor about some indigenous people of Auslet called the Auslettistas who were demanding land rights and better working conditions. Jimmy rushes off to work and says that something bad is about to happen to profit potential in Auslet. He says, I think we should start selling our investments there. In fact, let's not just sell our Auslet stocks, let's also sell short on the Auslettas to bet that the Auslettas is going to drop in value against the US dollar. Selling a currency short means that Betters Inc. will enter into agreements to sell the currency at today's price at some point in the future. The price is $1 for one Auslettas today. It's pretty much a win-win situation for Betters Inc. If the Auslettas doesn't get devalued, they don't lose anything. If it does get devalued to, say, one Auslettas for $0.5 or 50 cents, then at the agreed date in the future, they can buy an Auslettas for 50 cents US and sell them back for one US dollar according to the original short selling or forward contract they entered into. Jimmy's boss, who barely remembers who or what Auslet is, says, well, that's a fabulous idea after finding out how much money they could make by being the first on the block to start the attack. So Betters Inc. sheds all its Auslet stocks and enters into contracts going short on the Auslettas. Other investors see what's going on and say, oh, I better get out of Auslet before I lose my money. Once the attack has started, the only two things that can happen are that either the currency stays the same value with respect to the US dollar or it will lose value. You can rest assured it will not increase in value once Wall Street has started an attack. So it's safer for the investors to start pulling out, and it's extra profitable for them to also start taking short positions on the Auslettas. As the Auslet central banker, I want to prop up the value of the currency and give investors confidence that the dollar peg can be maintained, so I might actually be on the other side of many of the shorting contracts. All of a sudden, demand for the Auslettas has dropped drastically versus the US dollar. As central banker, the only way I can maintain the value of the Auslettas is to keep demand up by buying Auslettas in the open market with my US dollar currency or bond reserves. If the attack continues for long enough, I know my US dollar reserves will run out. While I am buying up Auslettas to keep their value, I am taking them out of the money supply. The Auslettas money supply is shrinking. Interest rates are going up. Investment is decreasing and unemployment has shot through the roof. Riots are breaking out on the streets of Auslet, but I can't do anything about it because I have to use all my reserves to keep the value of the Auslettas equal to the US dollar, especially because our government has all this debt denominated in US dollars. But the attacks keep coming from Wall Street. Soon my reserves are almost completely depleted. The Auslettas money supply is shrunk and interest rates are sky high. This interest rate differential and the 1-to-1 Auslettas dollar peg is encouraging a new type of bet against my country's currency that is further draining my reserves. At this point, I just can't keep the peg anymore. I have to devalue my currency by half so that I can justify a reasonable Auslettas money supply with my much depleted reserves. Wall Street wins. Jimmy, the original instigator of the attack, was going on pure speculation about my country that may or may not have had any basis to it and may or may not have materialized. Sure, he will get rewarded for his attack with a promotion, and this will encourage him to look for more attack opportunities. In any case, if Jimmy's information about the Auslettistas was correct, all it is saying is that if my country of Auslet shows signs of real democracy and some redistribution of wealth, well, my currency will be brought to its knees. This is exactly why the Zapatista uprising of 1994 culminated in the Mexican peso crisis, though there were many other factors involved, and this was one of them. When this attack happens, I am left with a devalued currency, more expensive imports, inflation, high interest rates, and probably unemployment and a discontented public. But even worse, Auslit now has a huge US dollar denominated debt that is essentially doubled in size with respect to my country's economy. Either the Auslit government will default on its debt, or, as has happened under the IMF throughout the past two decades, the IMF will come and help Auslit restructure things so that we will be able to pay off the debt. Usually this means cutting spending on social goods to direct more funds to the debt repayment that has doubled in size relative to our own currency. It also means making my country more export-oriented and attractive to foreign investors to attract the US dollars to pay off the debt. Often this results in sales of labor and natural resources at fire sale prices. We must now discuss what is known as the unholy trinity. In all of the above examples, under the gold standard, the original Bretton Woods system, and the example of Auslit under today's non-system, it was clear that the following three things could not simultaneously exist for any of the currency regimes. These three things are 1. Free investment capital flow between countries, 2. A fixed exchange rate or pegged to the US dollar, 3. Autonomous control over domestic monetary policy or credit creation powers. That these three cannot exist simultaneously is known as the unholy trinity theorem, and it is widely documented throughout the mainstream economic literature, and I will post some references on the Wizards of Money website to this theorem. The Wizards of Money website is at www.wizardsofmoney.org. The unholy trinity is not such a big problem for the developed world because under free capital flow, they just let their currency exchange rates float fairly freely and they don't wobble around too much because these are the major industrialized nations. Where the unholy trinity has profound implications is in the developing world, where these smaller economies have tried to fix their currencies to the US dollar to prevent excessive volatility that would come from constant speculation. This has meant that the central banks of these countries can only use monetary policy to manage the exchange rate and therefore can't use it to deal with pressing internal issues. When these internal issues start to arouse suspicions of speculators, the currency gets attacked with tremendous force from Wall Street, and the resulting devaluation will be sudden and drastic, and so will the IMF austerity measures that follow. The sad facts are that the speculators may have known nothing about the country in the first place and or may just be reacting to some emergence of democracy in the developing nation. Furthermore, Wall Street has ultimate control over credit creation in the reserve currency that these countries use to back their own national currency, and so it is always guaranteed to win. Once an attack is started against the currency, Argentina is now faced with such a crisis with its decade-old dollar peg of 1 Argentine peso to 1 US dollar and over 100 billion of debt denominated in hard Western currency. In order to maintain the dollar peg, the money supply has shrunk and interest rates are close to 30%. Unemployment and poverty have risen, government spending has been shaved, and the Argentine people are not happy. In a classic demonstration of the ignorance about foreign nations that Wall Street speculators so happily attack based on their wisdom about them, the Wall Street Journal ran a rather offensive article about the Argentine peso crisis in its October 26 edition. Typical of American ignorance about Argentina's history, the article by Michael Sazet in the Global Player section could do little more than compare the current crisis with the famous musical about the Perón dictatorship. It is quite frightening that the Wall Street crowd with similar ignorance about foreign issues is the same crowd that gets to instigate the speculative attacks that collapse currencies. Even though widely acknowledged as a problem in mainstream economic circles, the IMF refuses to address the reality of the unholy trinity. Presumably this is because, while they admit it exists, it's actually been very profitable for Wall Street. We shall finish today's edition of Wizards by talking about Wall Street's stealth fighter, known as dollarization. Faced with the harsh reality of the unholy trinity, large outstanding US dollar denominated debt and the subsequent need for US capital flow, coupled with exhaustion from Wall Street speculative attacks, many countries' governments are just giving up and letting Wall Street have it their way. They are abandoning all hope of maintaining their own national currency and passing all monetary decisions over to the United States. They are, as the IMF is increasingly recommending, agreeing to dollarization, that is, throwing out their sovereign currency and officially adopting the US dollar as their currency. This solves the problem of fixed exchange rates and stops forever the Wall Street speculative attacks causing devaluation, but it does so at tremendous cost to these countries. No longer do they have any credit creation or monetary policy powers, or even the ability to act as lender of last resort to their own banking system. They cannot use capital controls to protect themselves from volatile capital flows because now all their money is made in the USA. Rise in demand for labor and environmental protections would instantly be met with the sucking out of the medium of exchange like a vacuum cleaner, leaving only the debt behind. The control of the medium of exchange that drives their future economic life belongs in the hands of the US banking system and the US Federal Reserve. Furthermore, US banks may come to dominate their banking system and thereby increase their influence on national governments. This is certainly not helped by the fact that, as well as being in control of US monetary policy, the Federal Reserve also plays the somewhat conflicting role of umbrella financial regulator under the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. It's a one-way street and it seems headed for disaster. At this point, it looks like Argentina will either follow this path or devalue its own currency and default on its debt, or it will get bailed out by the IMF, who will then impose worse austerity programs. On January 1 this year, El Salvador took the path to dollarization. Only time will tell how this will work, but the immediate effect was utter chaos, according to an article on CorpWatch's Interpress service on January 5th. With a great deal of poverty and a high illiteracy rate, the people of El Salvador hardly knew what was happening to them, as the old currency could no longer be used and they didn't know how to change into the new one. While the IMF and Wall Street will push for dollarization as a way to deal with the unholy trinity dilemma that benefits them, others must realize that there are other solutions that are better for the majority of the people. One obvious solution is to use capital flow controls to ward off speculative attacks from Wall Street. And this has been used successfully by Chile and Malaysia recently. Also possible is the development of monetary unions for groups of Asian and Latin American countries, similar to the European Monetary Union. But this requires a Herculean effort in terms of diplomacy and putting the long-term interests of these countries' people ahead of the short-term gains possible for their leaders. There is also the possibility of people and communities and activists and NGOs creating the ultimate money resistance by setting up their very own currency regimes. We shall discuss this further in the next edition of Wizards. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 5. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website at www.wizardsofmoney.org, where you can get the text of Wizards episodes and find more references.
Gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.